Wednesday, March 16th. We are on the cusp of the beginning of the first round of the men's basketball championship, and the women's basketball championship is already underway. Welcome back to the A10 Talk podcast. Sam Basil alongside Daniel Frank. Daniel, after a big week down in D.C., we finally got a chance to hang out, you know, spent a lot of time with all the A10 Talk guys. A lot of great basketball. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. We got two teams for both the men's and the women's side into the NCAA tournament. Crazy stuff with Dayton getting knocked out by Richmond, both in D.C. and then proverbially with the NCAA tournament as well. Crazy stuff, but had a blast in D.C. Always great to have the tournament in my backyard, and hope the A10 comes back again soon.
Yeah, next year they'll be in my backyard, so that'll be great. Save me a lot of money on some hotels, and I'll be able to take the subway instead of the D.C. Metro, which I was going to put this on Twitter, but I wanted to save it for here. This is my final hot take of my week down in D.C., in that I think the New York subway kind of blows the D.C. Metro out of the water. I don't know if that's a hot take. But
in what capacity, in terms of like area covers or cleanliness or
not cleanliness, but area, in terms of area, maybe area covers. I think the DC Metro covers a pretty wide area. I think it's pretty good. My thing is, why does a subway have peak and off peak times? I mean, for New York, you can go pretty much anywhere you want to go. You can go from the Bronx all the way down to Coney Island for $2.75 if you want to. Anytime, any day of the week.
DC Metro is all about that money. They're desperate for money.
And these
even before COVID,
they take a long time in between each other. I mean, I feel like if you were, you know, coming out of the Verizon Center at night, I'd be waiting maybe like 20 to 25 minutes for a train. Well, if that was coming out of the Big East tournament out of MSG, I mean, there'd be some problems. You know,
there is reduced service right now because over half of the fleet is out of service. Due to a brake issue. Like they're running at half capacity and every line is every 20 minutes, even during rush hour. So it's better than it was. At one point, it was every 30 to 35 minutes. So we've made a little progress, but it's a bit of a shit show.
Wow. Well, you know what? Maybe next time I'm down in DC, it'll be a bit better. But, you know, while I was not impressed. While I was not impressed with, you know, how the trains were running, I was impressed with a lot of the basketball that we saw, you know, this week in D.C., specifically with Richmond, you know, taking down Davidson in the final of the men's tournament. So, Daniel, I mean, we were talking about it all season. I mean, me and you were running through scenarios, talking about bids and everything, and our mantra for the past, you know, 2 to 3 months, maybe even 4 months, was Dayton's got to make the final and they have to lose to VCU or Dayton. While we were very right about the method for how the Atlantic 10 was going to get multiple bids this season, we were completely wrong about who was going to be in the mix, as Richmond, you know, took down both of those teams in two consecutive days as a six seed in the tournament to win their first Atlantic 10 title since 2011, their first time in the tournament since 2011. Daniel, you know, just as a whole, I mean, what can you say about this Richmond team that might not have already been said, you know, earlier on this week?
I think one of the more interesting things about this Richmond team is it wasn't necessarily who you would have expected who made some big plays for them. I mean, obviously, Jacob Gilliard was the guy all week, especially against VCU. Especially against Dayton, and then hit some big shots as well in the final. But I really thought Matt Grace really stepped up, and so did Tyler Burton. I mean, I think if you would have asked anyone, pick two guys that are going to make the winning plays for Richmond in the A-10 championship game, most people would have gone with Gilliard and would have gone with Gilliard and Grant Golden. And the fact that it was Tyler Burton and Matt Grace who the two guys who hit the game-winning shots with the two big and ones in the final, I think spoke to more of Richmond depth than I think we were giving them credit for. And I don't know if just I wasn't paying enough attention to them or what it was, but I give them a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, you know what? With Matt Grace, I mean, I think it's different for both of those players, right, going into this tournament. Gilliard, obviously, he won the most outstanding player of the tournament. I don't think anyone was more deserving of that award than Gilliard. I mean, there was a lot of great players. I mean, there were a lot of great teams, but I just don't think, you know, I mean, you look at a team like Davidson, right, in the final. I mean, they had so many guys that were contributing, but none of them were – it was just – it's weird to say, right, because Davidson's a very good team. They're all – they spread the ball too well when it comes to, you know, singling out a guy for awards. They're just too good of a team overall. And so Gilliard, I don't think anybody, you know, carried their team into the later rounds and into the championship, obviously, more than Jacob Gilliard did. But, you know, with guys like Matt Grace and Tyler Burton, Matt Grace, straight up, no one was expecting him to do anything like that. I don't think, you know, I don't really think he was part of that, you know, conversation as one of the biggest Richmond contributors all year, maybe for his entire career. But I mean, he came up clutch, and that's what you need guys to do in March. You need guys to kind of step in and play that unlikely hero. I love that quote from Grant Golden. They get some great quotes, by the way, in their final press conference. If anyone has a chance to go watch that press conference again, I would definitely recommend it because it was super fun. But Grant Golden said, they were like, what were you telling Matt Grace when he was about to go to line? He's like, just make the free throws, man. Like, that's it. That's all you got to do.
That's a great quote. I'll be honest with you. I have not gotten a chance to listen to that press conference yet because I didn't even go down for it. I was too busy on the court, soaking it in, taking pictures with folks, taking pictures of the trophy and the ticket. I completely was just like, press conference. I'll watch it on YouTube later. I sat through 12 of them this week. I'll just do that.
It was one of those things where, you know, I think Richmond was really, really waiting to be given that platform. You know what I mean? In the sense that, I mean, they've gotten chirped for like 2 years now.
Oh, relentless.
We're not innocent parties. No. You know what I mean? You know, they were picked number one, to finish number one in the 2020-21, you know, preseason poll. They did not come up. They came up very short. They lost to Duquesne. On like the second day of the tournament, I believe they were like, they only made it to like an A seed. Then coming into this season, you know, they were not really in the mix at all. I think they were maybe like third or fourth in the preseason poll, but you know, people were like, oh, they're too old. Grant Golden's 40.
Quote of like, someone said to Grant, you're 30, stop playing. And he's like, well, now I have to score 30 points or something tonight.
That was like, Gilliard. Yeah. That was Gilliard who said that. He got 26. But he did get 32 in a game before in the tournament. So, you know, I think it's something that those guys definitely took in, they internalized, and they proved us wrong. And I thought it was great. One of my favorite quotes actually was from Chris Mooney. They were asking him, because obviously he's been there for such a long time as the coach. They were talking about his 2011 team. They're like, you know, Chris, comparing this team to your 2011 tournament team. And Chris goes, he's like, oh, you mean Grant's sophomore season? And everyone's so that was
great.
That was pretty good. So, you know, happily, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. And but talking about Tyler Burton, I am especially glad that he came up big, you know, late in that tournament game, because all season, I think we've been talking about out of the A-10. Of course, there could be guys that sneak in. There could be guys that make some surprises, but I think in terms of NBA prospects out of the Atlantic 10 this season, I think Tyler Burton is the man. You know what I mean? He's been considered a late second round pick. He's been floating around there for a long time. But as conference play kind of winded down, he took a little bit of a backseat. You know, I don't think there were some games where he was, you know, playing up to his full potential. But in that last game, I mean, he came up clutch. He played so hard. And, you know, he helped his team get the win. So I think that's going to be this game, when you're putting together, you know, Tyler Burton's NBA draft, like kind of highlight reel, there's going to be plenty of clips from this championship game.
No, I think you bring up a great point. I mean, we talked about this, I think after they played at Fordham, I want to say, and you mentioned that there were scouts in the gym that night, and that he had a kind of a so-so night. And
it's 0 points in the first half.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, the best thing he can do now, even if Richmond loses by 30 points to Iowa, if he has a good game, that will draw some more heads. Because, I mean, there's no brighter stage for basketball than the NCAA tournament. So to finally get to that stage and just even be able to just show his stuff to a broader audience is really going to help him out.
I mean, yeah, look at like Ja Morant, right? Like in 2019, I think they only made it to like the second round, but everyone was talking about him because he was putting up some crazy numbers and he got drafted second overall. So, I mean, I think the bar is not low. I don't want to say that, but like, I mean, I think it's accessible. It's accessible for a guy like Tyler Burton. So, you know, going into, you know, the tournament, we've got two bids from the Atlantic 10. We've got Richmond and we've got Davidson. In the first round, Davidson's going to be a 10 seed. They're taking on Michigan State, which I don't think you could have gotten, you know, story-wise, I don't think you could have gotten a better opponent.
Lawyer Bowl.
Yeah, the Foster Lawyer return revenge game. I don't really think he left on bad terms, but let's call it a revenge game just because we like to be dramatic.
Storylines.
And, you know, 12 seed Richmond going up against 5 seed, the Big Ten champs, Iowa. So first off, let's talk about Richmond and Iowa. Daniel, if Richmond has any shot, and you know, the 5 seed, 12 seed matchup has always kind of been one of those sneaky tournament matchups. You know, it's one of those things where I think it's more superstition than you know, actually that has an actual effect, like anything in the NCAA tournament. But if Richmond could be, you know, the next 12 seed to pull off that famous 5 seed upset over Iowa, what do the Spiders have to do?
I think they're going to just have to continue doing what they did so well in DC, which is sharing the ball and really getting everyone involved. I mean, yeah, there were a couple nights when one or two guys had a quiet night. You know, I thought that the Grant Golden didn't have a very good game against VCU. But when one guy went down, you know, with a lesser performance, the other guys around him kind of all stepped up and accounted for it in points. I think that's the number one key for Richmond is just they need to get everyone on, which I think they finally got everyone there by the Championship Sunday game in D.C. If they can continue to just do some of those things, I mean, obviously, Gilliard having 25 points is going to go a long way to Richmond putting in an upset bid. But I think Tyler Burton, if he can give you, you know, 15, 20 points, if Golden can get a double-double and really just spread the floor, Matt Grace hit some threes. You know, they can really, I think, be a problem for this Iowa team.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's really hard for me. I was saying I don't know if I want to, I don't know if I want to admit this on air. I guess it's already on my Twitter. I put my bracket out on Twitter today, but you know, maybe as an A10 talk guy, I'm kind of, you know, betraying the conference a little bit, but I do have Iowa making it all the way to my Final Four. I think this is a very strong team, but you know what, if Richmond pulls it off, I will be super, super hyped, and I would love to see them, you know, continue to push through. But now for Davidson, obviously the big storyline going into this game, I mean, maybe more so for Davidson fans than it is for Michigan State fans, but Foster Lawyer, you know, playing his former team, Michigan State. What do you like about Davidson heading into this tournament? What do you think they learned from that loss against Richmond that they can use against Michigan State?
I think they learned that they, which sounds ironic because Richmond was the one that had even more scoring droughts, but Davidson cannot afford to have extended scoring droughts. And their defense cannot afford to not rebound, I think, were the two biggest things. I mean, that was kind of what did them in. I mean, it looked like Davidson had the game in hand. I mean, they built a 7-point lead there in the second half. And then even with a minute to go, they had a 5-point lead with like a minute 16 to play. And, you know, they couldn't defend drives, basically. And that's how Richmond burned them, which is they just drove the ball straight up the gut. So I think Davidson will make the proper defensive adjustments. Bob, if there's any coach in the conference or the country, frankly, that can make those types of adjustments that I would trust to make an adjustment, it's Bob McKillop. I mean, they're going to be ready to go. I think, honestly, what this has done, or at least what I'm hoping it's done, is it's kind of woken up the bear a little bit here that Davidson, I think, as weird as it is to say, I don't think they had the best games in either the quarterfinal or their semifinal games. I don't think they're really pushed. I mean, in the quarterfinal game, I think they only hit 4 threes, and I think they've shown that they can definitely still win when they're having a poor shooting night, but even so, I didn't feel like they were really, you know, really challenged, and I think Richmond really was the first time that they were really pushed, and I'm hoping that what that will do is really motivate them, like, hey, we got to bring our A game every night. This is, you know, this is March Madness now. You got to step it up, And I think they'll answer that call.
Yeah, definitely. And so moving on to the other side of the Atlantic 10, you know, obviously we didn't get a chance to cover this, you know, what, like right after it happened, because we were both down in D.C. for the men's tournament. But the Atlantic 10 Women's Championship in Delaware, I mean, I know you got a chance to watch all of that, you know, UMass taking it. What did you like out of UMass's run, and what do you think they can carry into this women's tournament?
I mean, they were just so impressive. I mean, every step of the way, I thought they just looked cohesive. And that's really been their strength, I think, throughout the whole season, is they stayed together as a unit. They never seemed to get down on themselves. I mean, there was ample opportunity for them to really just say, ah, you know, we're hitting some adversity, you know, drop a few games here and there, you know, season's done, we're not going to get at large. But, you know, especially after the loss they had at Davidson, and then for them to come back the way they did, beat a very good form team who was probably underseeded, take out a very, very talented St. Joe's team. A St. Joe's team that, to be honest with you, reminds me a little bit of where UMass was a year ago. And then to take out the top seed in Dayton, and a game they really dominated from start to finish. I mean, they had a great start, and then Dayton, I think, reeled it into like five. And then after that, UMass just extended their lead back out. It never really got to under double digits until the very tail end of the fourth quarter. Dayton made a really late push. And I give the Minute Woman all the credit. They didn't get rattled. That was my biggest concern, is how would they respond if they got punched in the mouth, and they kept their composure. I was really impressed with, I mean, and all the stars really came out. I mean, Sam Breen, Atlantic 10 Player of the Year, absolutely was deserving of the most outstanding player of the Atlantic 10 tournament. I mean, she had a phenomenal tournament, especially in the second half against St. Joe's, and as well against Dayton. I really like this UMass team. I really think they're going to give Notre Dame a heck of a fight.
Yeah, so they're entering the tournament, you know, as a 12 seed against Notre Dame, the 5 seed, and Dayton grabs the at-large bid for the Atlantic 10. They're an 11 seed, and they're going to be playing Georgia, who's 20-9 this season as a 6 seed in the Greensboro region. You know, much, much better than how their men's team finished in their final year under Tom Crean. So
they have to win their play-in game first.
Oh yes, I'm sorry. They're going to be against DePaul in the playing game. Sorry about that.
Yes.
But which team do you think is more set up to make a big run in this tournament? I mean, they're both kind of going to be, you know, sleeper underdog picks.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think, as weird as it is to say, I think Dayton has a more challenging road to get there, in the sense that I think DePaul is going to be a really tough out for them. I do think the Flyers will get by DePaul tonight. Tonight being Wednesday night, the night of recording this podcast, they're playing tonight at 9 o'clock. So there's a possibility that everything else I'm about to say about Dayton is irrelevant, but I do think that Dayton has what it takes to get past DePaul. I think they're gonna struggle a little bit once they get to the first round. I'm not sure how much I love their overall draw for them, in the sense that I mean, I've got the bracket right here. Georgia's just a really physical team, and they have, I don't know, I know that there's the storyline of Shauna Green going back to her home state and playing in the state of Iowa for the first time, and her family's going to come down, and that's a really great storyline, and I'm hoping that they'll get some fan support down there. I feel like of the two, UMass definitely has the better chance. I really love their draw against Notre Dame. I think that Notre Dame it's just weird to say about Notre Dame, they're inexperienced in the tournament setting. They've not been back in a couple of years. This is the first time they've made the tournament since Muffet McGraw retired. So everything that you could have said about Notre Dame 5 years ago, you can't say about them now. I don't think they don't have an Arike Gumawale type of player. I think Sam Breen's going to have just a field day. I think she has I think this matchup's well for her, that she could drop 20, 25 points. And then you add in, you know, Sid Taylor, Destiny Filoxi. I think UMass, it's not outrageous to think UMass could make the second round. Hell, they could even make the Sweet 16. That's probably a little ahead of ourselves. I only think they'll win one game, but I really like UMass's draw here. I think this is as good as you could have hoped for UMass.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you bring up a great point. I don't think it's really ridiculous to, you know, say that that Notre Dame's inexperience is to their detriment. I mean, that's what it takes to win in this tournament, right? It's way much more of a mental battle than it is, you know, a battle on the court. I mean, you know, teams that, you know, what I've so far in my research for both of these tournaments this year, I feel like what it really comes down to, and there's a pretty good like meme video that I don't remember who does it, but they're talking about, you know, kind of like the ending of every NCAA tournament game ever, and it's just guys like, you know, running up the field. Oh, this guy loses the ball. Oh, he misses the shot. He grabs the ball. You know, blah 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 blah. There's a baby on the court. It comes down to, you know, teams that can, you know, stay calm, stay focused, and honestly not turn the ball over. And so, yes, you know, the NCAA is a lot of times driven by, like, you know, hot new freshmen, right? But at the same time, you know, those teams often disappoint. I mean, they'll unless you're, you know, a Zion Williamson, but I mean, even or like an Anthony Davis. I mean, even look at or Paige Bueckers. Like, even look at Zion Williamson. Like, Zion did not win a national championship. You know what I mean? He was one and done. He was the best freshman in the country.
Well, everyone was so high on Cade Cunningham a year or two ago from Oklahoma State, and sure, you know, they did okay, but they didn't make it. I don't even think they made it the second weekend. Like.
No, and Cade Cunningham's a great player. He's probably one of the best players we've seen in the college game in a very long time. But talent doesn't win this champ. Talent does not win this tournament.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. It's composure, it's good coaching. It can help, but it's there's so many more things that go into it. Just because this is such a in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of sports, like, this is such a messy, strange event. You know what I mean? No other tournament on earth is as complicated as the NCAA tournament.
But it's what's so beautiful about it. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, and this is what will always separate college basketball from anything like college football. Like, Duquesne had a truly rough outing this year in conference play. They lost, like, what, 16, 18 straight games. Duquesne still had the ability as of March 1st to win the national championship. Obviously, it's a hell of a hill to climb, but all they theoretically would have had to do would just be win five games in the conference tournament and then win six in the NCAA tournament. And Duquesne, as bad as they were, had the ability to win a national championship. And that is what is so beautiful about college basketball.
It almost seems like unfair, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I know we talk, I've talked about this, I've debated this with people all the time, and I really flip-flop on where I stand on it. You know, you see some conferences like the NEC last year or the Ivy League this year, where they don't let everybody in their tournament. Like, you almost kind of have to qualify for the playoffs, like a real sports league. Well, I think I don't hate that system. I still love the craziness that an all-inclusive tournament, you know, provides.
I mean, this is the thing. Like, the A-10 this year is a perfect example for the men. Davidson, I think head and shoulders showed that they were the best team over the course of the regular season. Richmond was a sixth seed, but they were the better team that day. And what do the best teams do when this is what's like, everyone said this about college football for the longest time. We don't want the best team on paper. We want the best team on the field. Davidson may have won that game 9 times out of 10, but Richmond that one time was the better team. We decided that on the court. Like, Richmond got the better Davidson that day. Richmond earned their way to the NCAA tournament. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the AP can sit and vote who they think is the best team in America. But at the end of the day, whoever wins six games over the next 3 weeks is the best team in America.
Yeah. And you know what I really think helped Richmond get that far is the fact that, like, this is the sixth Atlantic 10 tournament that Grant Golden's and Jacob Gilliard have been a part of. Obviously with NCAA eligibility and stuff, like, I don't think it's definitely not the sixth tournament that they've played in all the way through, but, you know, they've been there and they know what it takes to win. They know this conference as well as anybody, maybe as well as some of the coaches in this conference. You know what I mean?
I mean, Grant Golden was at Richmond longer than Jamin Christian survived at GW.
Yeah. Well, you know what, let's actually talk about that. Let's move on to our next topic. So, you know, as some of these teams, you know, move on to the NCAA tournament, into the NIT, You know, there are a lot of teams right now who are done. They're ready to move on next year. So we have three head coaching vacancies in the Atlantic 10 on the men's side. That's David Cox, Jamie and Christian.
Matt McCall. Mr. Lame Duck himself.
Yeah, who honestly, it slipped my mind because, I mean, look at the run that he had. I mean, they won that one game. And, you know, they almost looked like they could, you know, keep challenging. So, Daniel, you know, I think when the news came in that Christian was leaving the program, you seemed pretty surprised. I mean, I think some people saw it coming, but after the way that they kind of finished the season, you know, there was some thought that they might give him another go at it. So could you kind of talk about your perspective on that decision?
Yeah, I feel like I've gone through like the seven stages of grief with this in the last 24 to 30 hours or so. I had absolutely no prior warning that this was coming, and nor did anyone that I talked to, basically. I mean, I've been following Jimmy basketball for 23 years. I'm probably too well connected within the program in terms of folks that, you know, will feed me bits of information. I knew, for example, like when Jen Rosati was getting fired, I kind of had inklings of that ahead of time. The former women's coach. I knew when Mojo was on the way out the door, like, you know, all of these things I had prior warning. Absolutely no one that I talked to, not a single person in the GW department, like, not the department, but just folks that are in the know, had any indication that this was coming, and certainly not as quickly as it was. I mean, I think the general consensus was, is Jamie and our savior, is he the one to get to the tournament for the next level? No, but it was at least for the first time since 2018, we weren't in the pillow fight. And there was progress being made, and, you know, we had some talent. Is it the right kind of talent that GW wants? Maybe not. You know, Joe Bamzo maybe is a little bit showier of a guy than GW is looking for. But at the same time, they got seventh place, and they finished higher than any team in the Atlantic 10 did in terms of, you know, where they're projected to finish. And I think we all kind of said, well, you know, obviously the loss to UMass and the way that they lost, giving up 99 points, was embarrassing. The turnout was embarrassing in terms of fan support at the tournament. But I think we all kind of said, look, he gets another year. He's earned another year. And when I got on Twitter and saw, oh no, he's not coming back, was a shock. And obviously I think you're going to see GW house, clean house in terms of, not clean house, but I mean, Joe Bam's under the portal today. I expect we'll see James Bishop and Breon Freeman and a bunch of other guys leave. I mean, that's what happens when a coach gets fired.
And I'm sure the rest of the coaching staff as well, right? I mean,
the entire coaching staff is let go. Yeah. Which was also surprising. They basically, I mean, the message was loud and clear. This is not acceptable. Seventh place is not acceptable for GW. I don't care if you finally gets out of the basement. This is not where Jimmy wants to be. And not where we should be, I guess, is the messaging from the higher ups. And, you know, there's a point there. And there's an argument to be made that if Jamie Christian wasn't going to get Jimmy to the next level, then what's the point in keeping him anyway? Which I get. And I guess at the end of the day, this decision will be evaluated by who the next guy is and how well they perform. If they, you know, come up with someone that, you know, whether it looks like on paper initially a slam dunk or not, if they do well, obviously it's a great decision. But if we end up with another just like, you know, 3 years of so-so coaching and, you know, maybe finishing outside the pill fight every couple of years, then this decision may not look as good down the road.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I too was a bit surprised. I mean, going into the season, I thought that this was going to be the last year of Jamie and Christian at George Washington. But you know, by the time they clinched that seventh seed, I was like, okay, it looks like they're going to give them another shot, especially because you got guys like James Bishop and Joe Bamisil. I mean, those are guys that you want to hold on to, you know what I mean? Even if you're not too happy with how they're being coached, you want them to stay with your program. But looking at how George Washington kind of floated in the standings over the years. Yes, this was their best season so far. But the line didn't really, it wasn't like a straight trend upwards. You know what I mean? It was, they were tied for 10th and they were 11th in the conference and then they finished 7th. So if you're not showing clear signs of improvement, I understand why they would let you go. Overall,
yeah,
a little surprised, a little disappointed.
Yeah, and I mean, I just one last thing before we can move on to the, because I don't want to spend too much time on GW. But since 2017, which was Mojo's interim season when GW got to 20 wins and lost in the CBI, they are 53-92. Wow. And have not had a winning season since 2017.
Wow. So yeah, I mean, it's like who can, you know, who can take over, you know what I mean, and get this program straight. But, you know, actually, you know, let's talk about that though. I mean, I know you're still kind of recovering from the shock of this news, but I mean, is there anybody in your head that you think might be a good fit for this program?
I don't know. I know one name that's been floated a little bit is Mark Turgeon. I don't know if he'd want to come to a mid-major. I don't know if GW could pay him enough to pull him. There's a lot of folks who are like, oh, John Thompson III, under no circumstances will John Thompson be coming to GW. The donors would never allow it. There's too much bad blood. I wouldn't even want him. No. Beyond that, I've seen some folks saying, oh, let's get Carl Hobbs back in here. And at the end of the day, GW is going to have to come up with an identity here. They can't retread a coach. They can't pull a Louisville football and hire, you know, Bobby Petrino back a second time. Like, no, GW is going to have to forge their own identity and kind of figure out where they want to go. I've seen like John Becker's name float around. I've not seen anything too substantial yet. Certainly nothing as concrete as it seems like Rhode Island's gotten to, which we'll get to in a minute here. But kind of just in the wait and see mode, I think, right now for GW.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Let's move on to those other two, you know, head coaching vacancies. Rhode Island, you know, they've obviously let go of, you know, David Cox after a couple of years, you know, not what they wanted. So especially after the departure of Fats Russell, I mean, I think, you know, David Cox was a little bit on, he was on a little bit of shaky ground. You know, not really where Rhode Island basketball wants to be, especially after Dan Hurley, you know, after he brought them to an NCAA tournament or two. Right now, it looks like they're really talking. I've seen a lot of people almost pretty confident in the idea of Archie Miller at URI. I mean,
have you heard of Archie?
Yeah. Are you a fan of this?
You know, in a chaotic way, I kind of am. Purely because the A10 Twitter takes a load would be so chef's kiss. But from a logistical standpoint, I think if Archie Miller is going to get a bounce back position, I think he could seriously do good things for Rhode Island. They're not that far removed from making the NCAA tournament and being relevant. They're a lot closer more recently than GW has been, frankly. So, I mean, yeah, he's had a rough go of things from Indiana. And then obviously, the biggest question is if he wants to return to the mid-major level, which I think as long as he can put his pride aside, I think he'd do really well at Rhode Island. I think he can get him back competing. His first trip back to UD Arena would be something to see and how he would be received. I don't have a feeling that Dayton fans would welcome his return, but I'm a big fan of this, truthfully. I can't necessarily give you a why. I have a gut feeling that he'd do well there.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's hard to, I don't know. Of course, I'm not a Dayton fan, but it's hard to hate a guy who took you to an Elite Eight. But I mean, you know, the way he left and went to Indiana, I can understand why there's some bad blood. But I mean, this guy's a former A-10 Coach of the Year. I mean, he's got two A-10 regular season titles, 2017 Coach of the Year. Do you think right now, if he comes in, you know, depending on the people he recruits, the rest of the coaching staff that he brings in, I mean, he knows his conference. He was here for 6 years. I mean, do you think Rhode Island could, you know, almost immediately be propelled into the conversation as a serious contender in this conference?
I think the biggest question mark is how he would handle the transfer portal, because that's become such a key contributor or key component of coaching that I'm not sure if it really was to the same degree when he was at Dayton. That would be my biggest question, but I think absolutely. I mean, he could definitely assemble a team, both from a coaching perspective, coaching staff perspective, and obviously from a personnel player perspective that I think could, you know, maybe not win the A-10 right away, but certainly would not be pillow fight territory. That's for darn sure.
Yeah. And, you know, something that I thought was very great about Kyle Neptune in his first season, his first off season last year, was the fact that he was able to pull Chuba Ohams out of the transfer portal. Rhode Island right now, you know, if for anyone who's checked Daniel's excellent, you know, transfer tracker on a10talk.com. So if you haven't checked that out, you should check that out right now. Rhode Island's got four guys that are going out in the transfer portal. Antoine Walker, Trey Berry, Ishmael Leggett, and Malik Martin. Do you think there's any chance that a hiring of Archie Miller could get these guys out in time and back into the program? And B, would you really want to?
I mean, it's always tough to say because sometimes it depends, I guess, what the guy's beef is. If beef may not be the right word, but you know what their feeling is towards the school. If they have, if the issues were just, oh, I'm tired of losing and I want to go somewhere I can win, you know, look, they may not want to come back. If they're just looking for a better opportunity, a better coach to play for, then Archie could sell, I think, at least a couple of these guys. I mean, a guy like Antoine Walker and, you know, Ishmael Leggett, both who saw, you know, obviously some substantial playing time for Rhodey. I mean, I think there's potential there. If Rhodey pulls the trigger quickly here and hires, you know, Archie in the next week or so, even 2 weeks, I think, there's an opportunity to get guys out of the portal. If this drags on too long, which is what I'm worried about will happen with GW, then it's just the guys are going to find, especially a guy like Joe Bamsel, he's going to land on his feet. He's not going to be in the portal for very long. Whereas, you know, a guy like Trey Berry, maybe, you know, there's hope to get him out of the portal if he's still, you know, around at that time in which they make a new hire.
Interesting. So, you know, a lot of very interesting stuff at Rhode Island. I think it'll be a great landing spot for any coach, honestly. I mean, the fan base is really passionate. I think it's a program that people are really ready to get behind. So, you know, I guess we'll see. But finally, the third head coaching vacancy, you know, in the Atlantic 10 is Matt McCall. It's something that we knew going into the Atlantic 10 tournament. Something that we were a little bit surprised with after, you know, their departure in the Atlantic 10 tournament, considering the fact that, you know, how fun of a team they were in those first two games. But there's a name that's floating around that really kind of irks me, and I think you'll know what I'm talking about when people are talking about who can come in and take over UMass, just because, not that I think it's a bad name. I think it's one of the best names that you can get, but it's just not happening in Rick Pitino.
No, it's not happening. He turned down Maryland. He's not going to UMass. No.
He's one of those guys. he's just one of those guys where I think people don't – and I'm seeing this for Kyle Neptune too. And again, nothing's certain. Nothing's ever certain. You know what I mean? Guys can go anywhere. Guys can stay forever. They can leave after one, two seasons, right? Every time someone sees a coach – that's had experience in the high majors in the power conference, then start to do well, maybe in a mid major, they think, okay, they're just going to go springboard somewhere else to the next Power Five head coaching vacancy that they can get. And sometimes that's true. I mean, honestly, look at Dan Hurley. Look, now he's at UConn. Now he's doing great at UConn after being great at URI. But Rick Pitino, I think, I just don't understand why people think he would leave this Iona team, who, you know, they didn't make the tournament this year because they lost a Rider in the MAC tournament. They got upset, but he's still got a lot of good stuff. I mean, he's got two of his best players returning for next year. I just don't see him trying to, you know, go back to square one to build a team at UMass.
Oh, especially, I mean, what was the last time that Rick Pitino had something that was unfinished that he had left to do? I mean, he has done basically everything a coach could do in their career. He's already in the Hall of Fame. He won a national title at Louisville. Don't tell me they didn't win it. That 2013 happened. Live with it. I mean, he's done about everything you can do. What better a way to end your career than by, you know, making a national powerhouse out of this tiny little Iona school that before this hiring, I'm not sure how many folks could find on a map or tell you what conference they're in. I mean, us absolute, you know, nutcases who are obsessed with basketball could probably figure it out. But, you know, the average guy on the street, you said, who's the head coach of Iona? They'd laugh at you and say, who the hell's Iona? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think he's got a good thing going there. I hope for his sake he stays there. I think it's good for his image. I like Rick as a former Louisville guy. I mean, look, what happened at Louisville happened, is what it is. Can't undo the past, but You could do rights in the present.
Honestly, this might be a hot take. It's not something that I think would happen, but I think it's honestly more likely that Patino takes Iona out of the MAC and into a better conference than he does, than him going to another school.
Iona to the Atlantic 10, you say?
I don't know about that. They're not there yet. But maybe like the CAA.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, it's one of those things we talk about conference realignment. I mean, we make the joke about Fordham to the Big East all the time. You know what I mean? Or maybe I just make that joke because I think it's funny and it gets people, you know, real riled up. But you know, one thing I hear people say that to against Fordham to the Big East is that St. John's would never let it happen. They wouldn't let two New York market schools in the same conference. And to that, I don't know about that. You know, I think a conference like the Big East would love, maybe not the Big East, but I think some conferences would love more like intercity rivalries. Wouldn't you? Oh, I mean, the NEC's got three New York based teams. The MAC got Manhattan and Iona, like, you know, 30 minutes away from each other.
No, I mean, the Atlantic 10 is a great example of this. Like, GW could have easily thrown a hissy fit and said, we don't want George Mason. You know, but on the contrary, they embraced George Mason when they arrived to the Atlantic 10. I mean, Mason's only like 15 miles, 20 miles from west of GW. Like, you're talking about, like, competition. The reason I think it will never happen to St. John's, though, is St. John's dies on this hill all the time that they are New York's team, but we play at Madison Square Garden.
I mean, that's like a pretty good like to stand on, though.
They spend so much money on it, whereas GW's knows they're not GC's team. They know Georgetown is. They know Maryland is. They know UVA's probably ahead of GW in terms of rank in DC, and they're in Charlotte, so like 2 hours away. Like, you know.
No, I think it's fair. I mean, I will say that, I mean, you know, as someone who kind of grew up, you know, I have stake in both parties, right? I'm a Fordham alumni, I'm a Fordham fan, Fordham writer, but I also grew up a St. John's fan. You know what I mean? Because I'm from New York. So I think the fact that they have, you know, the Garden and everything like that, like they are historically the premier New York basketball team, like they have that leg to stand on. I don't see why they wouldn't want to welcome some competition. You know what I mean? And right now it's like Fordham and Iona. I think is the biggest challengers. I mean, Iona a bit more than Fordham right now, but who knows?
So Iona and Fordham to the Big East. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, it's happening. Let's finally talk about our kind of last bit of info for the night. Well, maybe before we get into some NIT stuff, but let's talk about the transfer portal. So, you know, as I mentioned before, Daniel's got a really great, you know, constantly updating article on a10talk.com. Just giving you quick updates on every single transfer that we see going on in the Atlantic 10 on both the men's and women's sides. So, you know, just going over the stats real quick. On the men's side, we've got 18 transfers outgoing. The women's side, we've got 10 transfers outgoing. Obviously, nobody incoming. I think it's way too early for anybody to have made a decision on anybody who's in the transfer portal. So, Daniel, is there any... Give me like two transfers that you were like, yeah, saw that coming, and maybe like one or two that you're like, okay, I was a bit surprised by that.
Yeah, I'll start on the women's side here. Kaija Harbison leaving St. Louis is not the biggest shock in the world. It's a really tough pill to swallow, I think, for the Billikens and Lisa Stone. But it's not, I mean, after Rachel Kent left last offseason, to go to IUPUI is not a great look for Kaija Harbison also be leaving, but I can't say it's overly shocking. My biggest question is if Brooke Flowers follows in the suit. If Brooke Flowers leaves St. Louis, they're in trouble. But that one was probably not the biggest shock to me. The one that really kind of was surprising to me, Emma Squires announced today she's leaving Richmond, which is a bit of a shock in the regard that she got a lot of playing time. I really thought she fit a role well with the Spiders and what they've got going on down there. That one was a bit of a surprise to me. The other one, I mean, it's hard to pick just one or two. Jordan Wakefield from Mason, is probably not a surprise as well. Tough to see her go. I really thought she had a lot of talent. Nice kid. I obviously got to talk to her a fair amount with me covering the team. I certainly wish her all the best. As well as, I'll just give a quick shout out to Maddie Loader as well. Someone who was a 3-year starter at GW, didn't play a lick hardly this season with Carolyn McCombs. And I do wish Maddie all the best moving forward as well.
Is there anybody on the women's side that you have not seen, you know, throw their name into the portal yet that you think might be coming? You know, maybe a team that's still in the tournament. I mean, it's hard to say too, because you don't want
to. Hard to say. I mean, Brooke Flowers would be the one that I would be waiting to see if she's the other shoe that drops. Slew is not in any tournament still playing. If I had to pick a team, I'd say maybe Davidson. They're in the WBI, which is the women's CBI basically. And I have feelings about the CBI in general and whether it's good for anything or not for a program like the Atlantic 10. But all that is to say, if I had to pick a team of anyone who's still playing where I think there could be some movement of folks leaving, I'd say probably most likely from there. I don't see anyone from UMass leaving that's not already in the portal. There's a couple from UMass, like Siobhan Smith is already in the portal, and that's a known entity. So but I don't think there's gonna be like, I don't think you're gonna see like a Sam Brian leaving, like no. None of that craziness.
It's one of those things where, yeah, like, I mean, with Sam Brian, I mean, you see stars leaving teams all the time. But if you're someone who can, you know, stay out of school, make an impact, leave a legacy, I don't see why you would. I don't see why Sam Breen would even think to make a decision.
No, I mean, like Nathan said that the first thing that happens when Sam Breen graduates and finally leaves UMass, her jersey's got to get retired. And that's day one, she's got to get her jersey retired.
Yeah.
She's the absolute legend of UMass.
Like her name's already like pretty much in the rafters at this point.
Oh, yeah.
So on the men's side, there's been a lot. I think as soon as Selection Sunday ended, well, maybe not as soon as Selection Sunday ended, but like that Monday morning, I think the names just kind of really started piling on. Obviously, we've got a couple big ones. Joe Bamisil from George Washington. Obviously, you know, that's definitely due to, Jamie and Christian leaving the program. He's probably going to find something else. LaSalle, you know, Christian Ray, Anwar Gill, two big scorers from that team. Duquesne, I believe Primo Spears. No, sorry, Toby O'Connie leaving Duquesne. So that's a huge blow for them. But George Mason, 6 total transfers for the Patriots, the most out of any school in the A-10 on both the men's and women's side. Daniel, what do you make of this?
None of this is shocking. As someone who's got a little know-with in the program, none of this is shocking. Only one of these guys really saw any playing time whatsoever, and that's Xavier Johnson. TJ Gadsden averaged, like, I think he appeared in, like, 5 games this season. Sam Shelton, I couldn't pick him out of a police lineup if I had to. I'm sure he's a perfectly lovely dude, but I don't think he's played a single minute for the Patriots this season. Mike Gray looked really, really raw as a young freshman in the offseason before, you know, the season started, and never found footing, never found confidence at the Atlantic 10 level. Otis Frazier never really seemed to find his role either. He's a little undersized for the role that I think English wanted him to play. And he didn't have the ball handling skills to play at like a 2 or even a 3. So I'm not shocked to see him go either. Jamal Hartwell's not overly surprising in the sense that, you know, ahead of the season, he looked like he was going to be a key contributor, was going to have the green light to shoot whenever he wanted to. And his production just dropped off a cliff as the season went on. And obviously Xavier Johnson, for that matter, as well. I think you saw his production start to dry up as the season went along. And Kim English went more and more to Ronnie Polite, to the point that Polite started over him in the A-10 tournament. So none of these guys are in any way, shape, or form, I think, shocks. I think more than anything else, Kim is encouraging guys when – this is the thing I love about Kim. He's honest with guys. He's not gonna BS you and say, oh, you know, if you work hard, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes guys just don't fit at schools. Most of these guys are Paulson guys. You know, Kim's opening up like 5 scholarships here. And considering who we brought in with the portal last year, there's a lot of reason to be excited about George Mason. And the ability of the 5 scholarship slots to bring into the portal is an exciting thing.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think, yeah, the way you're describing how all these guys are leaving Mason right now, it kind of reminds me of Fordham last offseason. Yes, I think, you know, those guys are, we're getting a, you know, guys like Ty Perry, Joel Soriano, Oni Aisi, you know, those guys were definitely getting like an upgrade in terms of coaching in Kyle Neptune. Even so, it's a new system. It's a new thing they have to learn. If they have the opportunity to go somewhere else, it's almost the same move. You know what I mean? It's like you're hitting the reset button on the program. So sometimes that just happens. But before we finish up this this podcast, which could be the last, you know, podcast this season until maybe after the tournament, let's talk about some of the teams that we've got in the NIT. Big news for the A10: we are a 4-bid league in the NIT. On the Mets side, you know, something I think we were, you know, that's exactly what we were gunning for all year. So I'm super happy. Definitely not sarcastic about that at all.
I will say the NIT, once you win the first, I tweeted this out last night. Once you win the first game, all of a sudden it no longer becomes a consolation tournament that no one wants to be in. All of a sudden you're playing for something that does matter.
Dude, I love the NIT. I'm sorry. I'll stand by it. Like, yes. Like if you're, like, say you're Dayton or VCU right now, right? Or even St. Bonaventure, who was, you know, number one in the preseason. Yeah, it's disappointing that you're not in the NCAA tournament. But like, the NIT is awesome.
Oh yeah,
it's awesome, and I can't describe it any more than that. It's just super fun, and it's more basketball. I mean, like, how could you complain about that?
I mean, this thing, like, you're playing at, like, yeah, Bonaventure got a tough draw, but you know what? They got a road game at a Power 5 school, and they got the win last night. Like, at the end of the day, like this is where, like, I have issues with things like the CBI when you're in a pay-to-play situation and you're playing, like Jibby played UIC in the CBI in 20s. Like, who the hell wants to play? I'm not going to get excited about it. I'm sorry. I could get excited about playing Colorado. Like, I could get up for that.
Yeah, that's the thing about the CBI too, is like, you know, the CBI and the CIT, it's so dependent on who's denying invites. You know what I mean? Because people decline invites at a much higher rate than someone would decline an invite.
Mason was offered a CBI position this year and said hell no.
Yeah, so because of that, you know, you might be getting the first guy to say yeah, which might not be the best team. It might be, you know, it might be like an IUPUI or something like that, or a St. Thomas, Minnesota, who, you know, no offense to St. Thomas. I mean, they put up a fight against Fordham this year.
Shots fired.
In their first time in Division One. But when you're in the NIT, you know that you're getting really good competition. It's not, you know, the best competition in the country, because obviously they're playing in the NCAA tournament, but you're getting the next best 32 teams. So right now in the NIT, we've got four Atlantic 10 teams. Once again, it's Dayton, St. Louis, the Bonnies, and VCU. And they're all in a separate region. So in theory, right now, because, you know, obviously VCU and St. Bonaventure have already won their first round games, and Dayton and St. Louis are playing, you know, at some point tonight.
Dayton is up 15 in the second half with 10 to play. Dayton's looking good right now, even though they're having to play a road game at Toledo.
And Toledo's a good team.
Toledo's a very good team. They're 26-7.
So, Daniel, the question I pose to you is, what is the likelihood that we see an all A10 Final Four at the Garden this year in the NIT? And
yeah,
or, I'm not, you know, sure specifically who's going to be the one that could not make that happen. Who's the weakest team heading into this NIT?
Well, right now I might have to say St. Louis, because Yuri Collins is not playing tonight. If Yuri Collins is not able to go for St. Louis, that might alone take them out. And I know Dayton's also down a man with Deron Holmes, was seen in a walking boot before the game tonight. Though obviously with them being up 15 points with 10 to play, you know, I'd say I'll pump the brakes, because Dayton was up 15 points with 10 to play to Richmond. But I think it's going to come down to one of those two if it's injuries. I will say, if I had to pick a favorite, I'd go with the Bonnies right now. I think they had the most impressive win. They had, you know, just the worst circumstances thrown at them in terms of, oh, hey, get on a flight and play at like 11:15 at night, like with 24 hours notice, and they came in, like they got the job done. But I think it's quite realistic to say we get one, maybe even two to Madison Square Garden.
That's going to be a good time. Honestly, I've been looking at it right now because obviously I live in New York. Even if none of the A-10 teams make it, I'm going to try as hard as I can to get to that championship game because that's going to be super fun. Something I would love to see would be Dayton and Iona playing each other because they can play each other actually in the quarterfinals, to clinch a spot in that Final Four. And I would be super, super hyped. Obviously, Florida has to get through Iona has to get through Florida and Xavier in the first two rounds.
Florida's got no coach right now.
Yeah, so. Florida's got no coach right now. And Xavier is a
little fired their coach as well, actually.
Oh, wow.
They fired their coach after their win last night. So It's possible.
How do you do that?
I don't know. It's Xavier, man. Xavier's crazy.
That is the craziest thing I've ever heard. Well, we're going to have to get Captain Xavier a comment from him on that whole situation. I don't know if anyone here who listens follows him on Twitter, but he's a great follow for some Big East, shenanigans. But wow, that's interesting. Stuff,
this is March.
Yeah,
anything goes.
This is March. So yeah, I guess we'll have a good chance of a Dayton Iona matchup then on March 22nd or 23rd. But in the women's NIT, we won't be seeing an all A-10 Final Four, but we could be seeing an all A-10 quarterfinals. Obviously, the women's NIT looks like their draw is a lot more focused on, like regionality. A lot of these teams, it's a Northeast region. Oh, excuse me, we've got three teams in the women's NIT. So I got
BC, Rhode Island, and Fordham.
And Fordham.
All in one region.
Yeah. So we could potentially see a Fordham VCU matchup in round three of the tournament. And we can see a Rhode Island versus Fordham or VCU in the quarterfinals. Obviously there's a lot of teams that they're gonna have to get through to do that. And I mean the women's NIT is a 64 team tournament. So that's pretty big. Daniel, which A-10 team do you think is going to make the biggest run in the women's NIT?
Honestly, I think it could be Fordham. I like the way this lines up for them. Bucknell opening game and then Norfolk City or Drexel, I think those are both very winnable games. I think this is also an equally strong possibility that you get Fordham VCU that could play each other. I think that's not out of the realm of possibility. I think if that happens, I'd take Fordham over VCU. I think Rhode Island has quite the ability to make a run for it. It all depends on what their mentality is heading into this. My biggest worry with Rhode Island is they're going to have to play Boston College in all likelihood if they get to the second round. They've already played once this season, but they beat them. And if Boston College is out for revenge, I could see that being a problem for Rhode Island. But they get past Boston College all of a sudden. I think all of a sudden you're in the third round. Anything kind of goes at that point. So it'll be really interesting, I think, to see how all three of these teams, I think that all three of them have the ability to really do some damage in this tournament. I'm excited for this. The WNIT, I think, is something that doesn't get enough attention. And people talk about the NIT as one of the upsides of it as being a good springboard. And all that, I believe that to be absolutely true. But it's even more concretely true on the women's side. The last three champions of the WNIT have gone on to be ranked the following season and have all made the NCAA tournament the following season for the last 3 years in a row. So good stuff all around. A lot of great hoops being played at this moment and into the next couple weeks here.
Yeah. So, I mean, with all these big hoops, I think, it's going to be a bit slower of a time for the Atlantic 10. So I think the next time you'll be checking back into the A-10 Talk podcast, it's going to be following all the conclusion of all these national championships and all these NITs. So with that, I think we'll say, see you later. Come back in a month. Keep checking all the great coverage of all these Atlantic 10 teams in postseason play, off-season coverage with transfers, coaching changes on A10Talk.com. Follow us at A10Talk on Twitter. Follow myself, Daniel, and all of our excellent writers for all of your favorite 15 teams now. I think it might not be too early to say that yet. So all your favorite 15 teams in the country.
And we'll see you next time.